Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vikalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
As a native Iowan, I hear people, mostly politicians and pundits, use the term heartland, and the word always conjures in my mind images of a mixture of Leave It to Beaver, Green Acres, and Happy Days. Now, nobody I know in Iowa or throughout the Midwest ever uses the term heartland to describe where we live. It's always done by the outsiders, and that always intrigued me. Then along came Kristen Hoganson's book, The Heartland, An American History, and it's now available in paperback, and Kristen joins me now. Kristen, you grew up on the East Coast, now live and teach in Big Ten country, the University of Illinois. From where in your life's journey did this book originate?
The book started when I moved to East Central Illinois from the East Coast, and the first day there I turned on the radio, and out came the weather forecast for China, Argentina, and Brazil. And I realized that I had no idea where I had landed. I did not expect that, and the book is the result of trying to figure out more about the new place where I live.
The word heartland seems to be used synonymously by outsiders with the word Midwest, and I know sometimes I'll hear something about a Midwest man or Midwest woman did something or other, and then I'll find out that they live in eastern Ohio, and I think, well, that's not really the Midwest, because that's just not how, it's not geographically near me. But is there any central agreed-upon definition of the Midwest?
Well, there's not. People argue about the boundaries of the Midwest. They argue about where exactly the heartland is located. And that's one of the things that I argue against in the book, the idea that there are set boundaries that build walls between insiders and outsiders in particular regions. But one of the things that I found, the more research I did, is that particular places, even places you might think of as local, have spilled over into much wider geographies and are knit to global circuits of connection. And even more surprisingly, have been so from the beginning, before locality even existed, before the heartland even existed. It was basically produced by the entire world. And so then to arbitrarily go in and set boundaries and claim that there are specific lines that would separate eastern Ohio from the rest of the heartland, the Midwest, the other proximate areas, just doesn't make sense to me. If you think about place, not only is buffered and isolated, but as something that spills over into other areas by virtue of human and other connections.
You write about the Kickapoo people, a Native American indigenous Mexican tribe. What was it about this historically undercover group that made them so essential to the narrative of your book?
Essential because they help tell a story, but they're not the only group that could tell this particular story. And the story is one of just astounding geographic mobility that goes back to the earliest days of European colonization, during which time the Kickapoo tended to live in the what's now the Windsor, Ontario, Detroit, Michigan area. And then because of the violence of the fur trade, they were pushed by the Iroquois westward, more into Michigan, Wisconsin, Indiana, Illinois. And then in the 19th century, they were forcibly removed from places in the Midwest where they had been living, forced even further west into places like Kansas and Oklahoma, somewhat to Texas, somewhat to Mexico, where they established Nahido, which is a community land grant. And they continued to maintain ties across the entire Kickapoo diaspora during this time period. And so one of the things that I do with the story of the Kickapoo is think about the idea of locality, the point being that locality did not exist in the Midwest until settler colonists, the pioneers, came in and invented it. And they invented it as a political claim to establish their own rights to place. And the way that indigenous people experienced locality was as a form of colonial domination. The locality was about being pinned down to place on reservations from which they could not leave without passes and military guards. Being quarantined was a huge component of locality, ending up in the U.S. penal system, having their children put into boarding schools where they had to sit at desks all day, and for women being told to stay at home to do housework and not to go out and about in the world. So one of the things then that the story of the Kickapoo does is help us think critically about what it means to be local, what the politics of locality are. And it also reminds us that there are people who are really by ancestry and also by emotional ties Midwesterners who may not even live in the United States, who may be located right now, for example, in Mexico, and who might still be struggling for a right to return.
Midwestern agriculture and its international roots make up a large portion of your book. And so how does this international-based industry resonate with the idea of the American farmer that makes up so much of the narrative we hear today about the heartland? We just don't think about the international aspects of it, or at least we're not told that narrative.
Well, your listeners in Iowa well know how important global markets are, right, for
sure.
Farm products, and have always had an eye on export markets. That's not something that is just an artifact of the 21st century. The interesting thing that I found in the historical research that I did is that it hasn't always been just a story of export markets, that a lot of the animal and plant material that enabled them to become so productive, by which I mean Midwestern farmers, has actually been imported genetic material, and many of those importations were 19th century importations and early 20th century importations. So the time period that I write about was a time in which the U.S. Department of Agriculture was one of the groups that was sending bioprospectors out around the world to scour for promising genetic material. It was a time period in which soy was identified as something that might do well in the Midwest and introduced to the Midwest. It was also a time of importing animals that were understood as superior to the already, you know, domestically bred animals. Animals such as the Berkshire hog, whose descendants, you know, can continue to exist on Midwestern farms, and also new forms of cattle like the Shorthorn cattle, which were very popular in the 19th century. And all these importations enabled Midwestern farmers to become much more competitive on global markets, and that's a story that's often overlooked.
Where you're at the University of Illinois, you use the Urbana-Champaign area as sort of a test ground for a lot of your narrative there. But as you look at the particular area where you've lived for the last two decades, do you see a lot of repetitiveness of the history of the area and the characteristics of the area as you look at other locations in the Midwest?
Right. So my book is a local history insofar as it starts in East Central Illinois, and then it onspools to the far ends of the world. So local history, you know, in part is a topic, but mostly it's a method. It's a method for trying to understand how place has been stitched into larger tapestries of space. So the story I tell is particular to my starting point, but the kinds of relationships I uncover you can find anywhere in the Midwest. And in fact, I dug around a little bit and spent some time initially trying to decide if I should write about a different place, and found very similar stories elsewhere. So I think in that respect, it's not unusual at all. But there's stories that are well known, stories of missionaries, of military personnel, of immigrants, that have always been part of Midwestern history. But the stories that I latched onto were ones that are not as well known, the ones that were much more surprising to me, which were in many cases stories of agricultural production, stories of farm life. And even let me, you know, just give you one example of, you know, for me, one of the most surprising things I found that would be true for Iowa, too, stories of figuring out bird migration. So I had no idea how important birds were in the lives of rural people who depended on them for protein, but also for insect pest control before there were synthetic pesticides. And upon realizing that bird populations were plummeting with the tiling and draining of wetland, with excessive hunting, Midwestern farmers became a major constituency for treaties, bird protection treaties, and other bird protection measures. And it was the Department of Agriculture then that took the lead in that, realizing that bird protection was a matter of food security. And, you know, that's true across the Midwest, not just in central Illinois.
I'm chatting with Kristen Hoganson about her book, The Heartland, an American History. The book is available now wherever fine books are sold, and it's available in paperback. Kristen, I know we've talked about it and touched on it throughout this talk we've had, but the actual term Heartland Myth, I've never heard that before until your book. What is the Heartland Myth?
Right. So the Heartland Myth holds that the Heartland is the quintessentially all-American place, that it is the core of the nation. And when I say the Heartland, I'm speaking specifically in reference to the myth to the rural and small-town Heartland, because there are actually two Heartlands. The other Heartland is the industrial Heartland, which has always been understood as the root of power, right? It's the place from which, you know, U.S. industrial might has emanated forth. But the rural Heartland is seen often as a more vulnerable place and as a more local, insulated, isolationist place, kind of the ultimate national safe space that needs to be protected because it is the true heart of the country.
And I thought about this, too, as I read. Were you able to trace back as to when the Heartland or that term or that idea came to be? Because, you know, it had to be after Western expansion, because the Heartland, you know, at the colonial time would have been somewhere further east. It just kind of keeps moving, but then it seemed to stop, right?
Right. So the term, you know, the Midwest has had all kinds of terms attached to it, including the Old Northwest, for example. Eventually, it became known as the Midwest. The idea of the Heartland first originated in the writings of a British geographer, Sir Halford Mackinder, in the first decade of the 20th century. And he thought about it in geostrategic terms. So his point was whoever controlled the Eurasian heartland would control the world. And this was an argument against navalist theories. It was a land-based theory of power. And the term began to circulate widely in the United States during World War II in reference what was going on in Nazi-occupied Europe. The thought was that Adolf Hitler and his war machine was trying to control the Eurasian heartland, and if he could successfully establish that control, he would establish world dominance. And then in the aftermath of the war, it became attached to the Soviet efforts to establish dominance over the same landmass. So it was always understood more along the lines of, you know, what I was talking about with the industrial heartland as a place that was the locus of power. One of the things that's so interesting to me now is that there's been a lot of talk in recent years about vulnerability, the idea that the United States is under siege, that threats emanate from elsewhere, that domestic problems really can be blamed on other people. And in those lines of talk, the heartland is always rendered as very vulnerable. And I think that line of thought overlooks that, in fact, it has also been a locus of power, that power has emanated out from the heartland, starting, in fact, you know, with the pioneers and the, you know, effort to colonize North America, and then radiating on from there, including them with farmers and their desires, you know, for export markets, and then to attain that, the need for coaling stations, bases, Panama Canal, naval building, and so forth. And I think one of the things that my book does is it shows that it's not really only the urban, industrialized manufacturing centers that have produced American power, but also the ways that rural communities have been deeply implicated in the U.S. exercise of power around the world from the very start.
Are there any grains of truth in the Heartland myth?
Well, there are grains of truth, but I think it's wrong to pin those truths specifically to place. So insofar as it holds, for example, that people in the Heartland have been local or insulated or isolationist, yes, there are grains of truth in all of that, but that's true across the country. And so I think one of the things that the myth does is it takes the place in the middle of the continent, and it assumes that by virtue of being buffered, by not being you know, coastal or borderlands or connected, that all these things hold true to a greater degree in the rural and small-town Midwest. And that basically implies that geography is destiny, and it misrepresents, I think, the rural and small-town Midwest, and it also lets other parts of the country off the hook for having many of the same attributes.
Well, you're in the midst of this coronavirus crisis at the University of Illinois. I know that you're, you know, the kids aren't meeting, the students aren't meeting. I'm always curious, because I live in Big Ten country too, what's the thought that if they don't play football this year, there's a huge amount of income that these universities are going to lose? What's the thought on campus there as you've talked to your colleagues? Anybody concerned about that?
Oh, my gosh. The concern is real. And, you know, I could do a five-hour interview on this. The students all want to come back. We all want the students back. This is heartbreaking. It's really, really difficult time for everyone. It is not the same providing remote instruction. That it is just a pale imitation of the campus life that we all know and love and the kinds of instruction that we typically provide. But it is very difficult to imagine returning to campus life as we have known it in the fall in the absence of, you know, the capacity to test everyone, in the absence of, you know, widely available hospital-grade personal protective equipment. It's just a time of huge uncertainty with the Big Ten football being just the tip of the iceberg from my particular team.
Well, and you know, 90% of the experience at a Big Ten university is actually being at the university, and so that's a lot of cultural experience these students are missing out on.
Right. So one of the things that universities have always done is just bring students together from different walks of life, and in fact from different parts of the country and the world. And, you know, to go back to my book for just a second, one of the stories that I trace is that of international students coming to the University of Illinois, even in the earliest years of the 20th century. There were students from places like China, the Philippines, Mexico, India, who came to Illinois to study agriculture even then. And that is, you know, something that's carried through to our own time, where we have a large number of international students who, you know, we have no idea if they'll be able to come back in the fall. And then just thinking about, like, what they bring to campus life, what all the different networks and student groups and activities on campus, you know, typically are like, this, you know, I'm thinking speaker series as well as sporting events. Just, yeah, to lose all that is really difficult. So I am very much hoping that people stay safe, shelter at home, do whatever it takes to bring the epidemic under control so that we can get back to life as we know and value it.
All right. Well, in the meantime, check out Kristen Hoganson's book, The Heartland in American History. It's available in paperback now, wherever your fine books are sold. Just an incredible exploration of this idea of who we are in the Midwest and in the heartland, as she says it, the heartland myth. It's so interesting. Kristen Hoganson, thank you for joining me to discuss your book.
Thank you, Brian, so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Vakalskis. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com. Also, be sure to like Having Read That on Facebook and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Sing a song.